All right, good morning, everyone.
This is the script to add.
All right, good morning. We'll go ahead and call the roll.
Okay. Aguirre.
Here.
Arambula.
Here.
Fletcher.
Here.
Frank.
Here.
Galvez.
Here.
Gomez. Hall.
Here.
McClellan.
Here.
Montgomery.
Here.
Moreno.
Here.
Salas.
Here.
Sankey.
Here.
Sotelo Solis.
Here.
Ward. Weber.
Here.
All right. We have a quorum. Is there a motion for the approval of the minutes from the January 16th and February 1st meeting? Motion and a second. All in favor say aye. That motion carries. Before we get to public comment, two quick announcements. We're going to add an item to our closed session agenda today if there's no dissent from the board. We want to request that the board get an update regarding pending litigation in the case of MTS versus Grand Central West. With a two-thirds vote of the board, we can add it to an agenda if there's need. We have a potential update along with the need for some board direction on this issue. And an update on settlement. So I would make a motion that we add it to the closed session agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Any comments? No? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. We will add that. The second thing is under the legislative agenda, I want to strip the recommendations surrounding public safety. I think that there were three recommendations, recommendations 1, 2, and 3, that are in the legislative package. We just want to take them out, maybe defer that to the Public Safety Committee for some further analysis or discussion of what that may be. I think if we take those three out, we can consider moving forward with the rest of the legislative agenda. So if there's no objection to that. Councilmember Gary?
There's no objection, but I just have a general comment as far as these types of items. My recommendation would be that we have them on a regular calendar, you know, for further discussion instead of on consent.
Sure, fair enough. Great. With that, not yet. I was just giving a heads up that when we get there, we've taken those three off. All right, with that, we will move to public comment. We have 8 requests to speak under non-agendized public comment, and we welcome all of our speakers. We will do 2 minutes each. We will start with Cello. After Cello will be Valerie Hightower. After Valerie will be Martha Welch. No cello? Oh, there you are. One more. Got it. 9.
Good morning. I have an appreciation for the many years I've lived here and have ridden the 929 bus, and there are issues there on the 929 bus. First of all, I did check into rules for riders, and rules for riders, you have the right to refuse animals with bad odors. Also, bad odors. And what about people with sick odors that can create health issues from very small to very serious? So people with sick odors. Okay, moving on. Packages, carry on. It says 18 by 30. Please, there's more than 18 by 30 coming on board that take over 2 and 3 seats on the 929. I'm talking about that only. Now, for designated seating, where you have the seating for the strollers and the carts, people are tearing off those little posters or little signs in black and white. There are none available, and this morning there was a corner of one ripped halfway off, so they have disappeared. I recommend redoing it in red, where it can't be noticed, and violation or prohibited should be the word. Red will attract them. They're ignoring it totally. You have new residents in Chula Vista. They are young mothers with babies, baby carriages. Several occasions I've been on the bus, and there are at least 4 or 5 baby carriages. So we're talking about keeping those seats clean, just steam cleaning, take care of, other than odors, that or stains? Does it take care of viruses, bacteria, and spores? Please check this out, the steam cleaning. What does it do? That's fabric seeding. Thank you. I do want to say I love your drivers. They are marvelous.
We do, too. Thank you very much. Ms. Valerie Hightower. After Ms. Hightower will be Martha Welsh.
As long as the buses and trolleys are running, security needs to be seen. Okay. You need to pair up these gung-ho hood boys with senior security, because they got the mentality, I can do this in my own accord. Another thing, security need to be visible at all trolley stations, especially the isolated ones, at night and out here. You know, I've been set out here on this island, had several bags. I don't know the people down here no more, and I had my mace out. And I appreciate the senior security coming around, and I showed them what I had in my hand, and I told them, I don't know the people, and this guy act like he wanted to snatch a bag. You know, I appreciate, but you got these young ones, you can't tell nothing to. And they're gonna get somebody, yeah. Now, your drivers, you got some ill-mannered, disrespectful, and inconsiderate drivers. They're running red lights, they're speeding up. Saturday, I was trying to get on a bus. The light was red at 47th and Imperial. He had the bus pointed out towards the street. I was there, waved my cane. He gonna act like he didn't see me. He told me, no, I couldn't get there. And I stood there, and I looked at the light and looked at him and looked at the light. He had to sit there for the red light. Another thing, there are bathrooms available for us to use. They need to be open. They need to be put a coin box for 50 cents. It'll help supply toilet paper, paper towels, and cleaning supplies. Give somebody back their dignity who's getting trolley tickets. Let them clean.
Thank you, Ms. Hightower.
Bathrooms. God bless your decision.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Martha Welch. After Martha will be Anthony LeBue, and then McGill Aguirre.
Martha Welch, you don't read the agenda. It says 3 minutes. Now the federal government is so mad at you. Now you want money for the state or federal, you can't op out anymore. You have to fund your own audits. You haven't done that for years. Right now, Bill Horn or William is in the federal in the hands of them. His real name is William. He can't call anymore. I know why you do this, because there's bribes here. SSD or don't do taxes. That's why you do this mean things here. I stand with the union right now. Like the 901, it should be drivers, but no, it's trans. That's what you do here. You don't follow the rules. Now, we used to have on National City, you had 967. Used to be a regular bus. Now it's small. It has steps. We have senior building and meals right there. Now, how can their walkers go in there and walk the steps? It's really mean. That's what you do. And it used to be another one, 968. It used to be there also. But you moved it someplace else. And I see that bus. No one's really on it all the time. Now, ninth benches. Now, on Broadway, ninth, you used to have a benches and down by the ninth street. No, because the construction, you move it back there. Construction is gone, but you haven't put the benches back up. That's why you do this thing. That's why you're mean, because you don't do these things. You see, what happens here, you lie to the federal government. You can't do any more. The FBI's back. I work with them. I tell everything I know about you do it, you here. And they've looked and they tell the federal government, same with the steps. Ocean's back and SSC is back. You can't, if you bonds, if you don't do the right thing with bonds, you're going to be in trouble, because SEC is back also, and they're mad at you what you do here, because you're doing the right thing. I saw the budget in 2015, $30 million for alcohol. You did nothing there. You didn't change it at all. You lie all the time. You guys are out of step with everything. MTA has to be the county.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you so much, Martha. Next up, Mr. Anthony LeBue, Miguel Aguirre, and then Nate Fairman.
Good morning. My name is Anthony A. LeBue. I'm here wearing several hats. The one you see happens to be a black beret. So first, I'm a Vietnam War veteran. I'm a U.S. citizen. I live in Tijuana. I'm a patriot. And my first proposal, if you will look at the flyer that I left for each of you, I've been crossing Mexican borders for longer than most of you have been alive, and I've been crossing the San Ysidro for over 20 years. I'm concerned about the wildcatter situation. I'm amazed that there's been no city, county, or any other government program to put up a flyer to advise the population at risk. So we're upgrading the flyer. You'll notice it's two sides, and these are courtesy of GWC, the proprietor of the McDonald's building. So I urge you to take this to heart and see how we can collaborate. There are many stakeholders here so that future flyers will have credits for all of the individuals, businesses, and agencies that want this message out to the public. San Ysidro is the gateway to the U.S. It's the largest crossing border in the U.S., and I believe that our visitors deserve protection from wildcatters. Second, please look at the flyer. I'm Director of Arts for Veterans. I've decided to promote a global military child fest to celebrate April, the month of the military child, which is promulgated by the U.S. Department of Defense. And I urge you folks to see if you can develop a program of using bus marquees and the art cards inside trolley cars and buses to promote April, the month of the military child, and art made by military children.
Thank you, sir.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you. Next up, Miguel Aguirre, then Nate Fairman, then Dan Allen.
Good morning, Laura.
Would you go to the podium for me? Thank you.
Good morning, Board. My name is Miguel Aguirre, Grand Central West. I had asked to have my time ceded to Tony Labou, and apparently that wasn't possible, so I've been advised by my counsel to refrain any comments since it's just been added to the closed session, but I'd like to take this morning to greet you all and thank you very much for your service.
Thank you. Nate Fairman.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Nate Fairman. I'm the business manager for IBW Local Union 465. I proudly represent about 200 mechanics and maintenance workers here at MTS, and as you see behind me, like I brought on Saturday in the previous board meeting, I just want to bring attention to the electric buses that MTS has purchased and the amazing work that our mechanics are doing on those buses. And also want to raise awareness of the electric bus hazard pay inequity that we presented at the bargaining table. It's really important to the mechanics, and also it's really important to the IBW to hold the line with regards to safety standards and training and certifications. And when those training safety standards and training certifications are increased drastically, to acknowledge that in a common sense hazard bus pay inequity. Just want to, if you have any questions, I've left my business card for every single person. You can call me directly. We are making really good progress at the bargaining table, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't raising the awareness to everybody that's affiliated with MTS. So again, the electric bus hazard pay inequity is extremely important to us. We believe the job of the mechanic is changing drastically, and with that, we should also address wages and training. I also just want to say a consent agenda item number 10, the amendment to Chief Executive Officer Employment Agreement. We are strongly supporting that. There is not a more hardworking man in San Diego Transit than Mr. Paul Jablonski. So we are in very strong support of that consent agenda item number 10. I would say right behind our mechanics, there's Paul Jablonski. So he could be a member of 465 if he wanted to go put one of these suits on. So we strongly support consent item number 10 for Mr. Paul Jablonski. Thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you, Nate. Next up, Mr. Dan Allen. Good morning, sir. You have 2 minutes.
Good morning.
He can be
Mr.
Right.
Fletcher and members. My name is Dan Allen. I live in La Jolla. And our community plan has, for at least 30 years, called for a connection with the trolley when it's finally built. You all know the trolley doesn't go straight through La Jolla, so we need some sort of connection. I'm here to see what the report's coming later in your agenda from the staff on some sort of a connection or feeder bus system. but I wanted to mainly come and say that we have, over the last couple of months, gotten endorsements from the La Jolla Community Planning Association, the La Jolla Town Council, the Business Improvement District, and several other organizations to emphasize the importance of funding a connection system for the eventual trolley, North Line trolley. And as well, we have support from the Pacific Beach Planning Group.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Our final three speakers, Annabelle Araúz, Bobby Angel, and Brian Pollard. Please make your way in that order. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Annabelle Araúz. I'm a business rep at IBW Local 465. And I'm just here to let you guys know that we are negotiating right now with MTS for our mechanics at Transit. We want to make sure that we do address the electric bus inequity pay for our members. Thank you.
Thank you. Bobby Angel, and then Brian Pollard. No, Bobby Angel? All right. Floor is yours, sir.
Good morning. I wanted to speak. My name is Brian Pollard. Manage the Urban Collaborative Project, which is a nonprofit in southeastern San Diego. I guess I wanted to speak really quickly about the subsidized fairing fare issue, but it's on the agenda, so since I'm here, I'm just going to tell you that I really support this. This has been going on for a very long time. It addresses a population that needs help in mass transit. What I would like to see is perhaps, rather than the 18 years and below, we raise it to 24 years and below. There's a huge population of people in my community, and I'm sure other communities, that this 18-year-old limit will not address a major population of folks. So give that some thought if you can. I applaud the fact that we're moving forward with this. It's been 6, 7, or 8 years, as far as I can remember, so thank you for that. Just maybe increase the ceiling to 24 years of age. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That concludes public comment. We're going to move to the consent calendar. We have two requests to speak on item 7. We're also making some changes to that, so I think it's appropriate we pull that from the consent calendar so we can cover the changes that are being made and hear from the public speakers. Other than item 7, are there any other items the board wishes to pull? Ms. Moreno? Or comments?
I just have a question on item 16.
Okay. Go for it. What's your question?
Is there staff here? No. I want to know who was responsible for the design problem that halted construction in 2018.
Here we go.
I can answer the question. The design company was RailPros. The design firm was RailPros. And we dealt with that issue, I think, a month or two ago in terms of the problems with the contractor and the resolution to it.
Okay, so the problem was with the actual design.
It was with the design, and the designer paid for the entire claim that the contractor claimed because of faulty design.
Okay, thank you.
So this is redoing it now.
Got you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Nothing else? Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar? Motion and a second. All in favor say aye. That motion carries. We will now take up item 7. Item 7 is the adoption of the federal and state legislative program. This would approve our staff recommendations for 2020 for federal and state legislative priorities. Again, I want to reiterate, we are striking items 1, 2, and 3 under Section 3 in public safety. That's an issue that I think would be appropriate if the Public Safety Committee wishes to take that up and make some recommendations back in. Otherwise, I think the rest of the legislative program is there. We do have two requests to speak. Maybe we'll hear from the two speakers, and then we'll give a chance for board members to weigh in. We have B. Mitt Miller and Sally Jacobs. I'm sorry, I can't read it too well. So you're both welcome to come speak on agenda item 7. We'll give you 2 minutes each. You can go in either order, whichever one of you wants to go first.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Sally Jacobus, and my interest in this particular agenda item is specifically that it's quite broad, and as far as allowing administration to take the advantage of overriding the board, I think it could be maybe not the most advantageous thing for the community. So I would like to have that re-evaluated. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. B.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm B. Mittermiller from San Diego 350. A couple of things. Looking at the transit funding category for the state program, seeking subsidies for specialized fare programs, I'm wondering if anybody can tell me how that relates to AB 1350, if that would have any effect on, if there would be any interaction between those two things. Also, I understand that the federal transit funding portion includes ferry funding from Coronado, from Coronado within the bay, and I hope that that will be funded at the federal level instead of by MTS. I think the MTS funds should be used for bigger items. Thank you for striking the first three items under public safety. I'm glad that's going to be looked at some more. I also want to say again that I, or to emphasize that for public safety, we really don't encourage the criminalization of fare evasion. There are other ways that that can be dealt with in a more compassionate and reasonable manner. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Concluding public comment, Councilmember Moreno.
My question on item 7, and I agree with my colleague, Councilmember Aguirre, that this item I feel should have been on a, what is it called? Not consent.
Not consent.
Yes, as it was last year. My question is, how were the capital projects chosen, for the federal legislative program's transit funding section? And more specifically, why is the ferry project, something that we haven't discussed as a body here, included, but the Blue Line Express and the San Ysidro Intermodal Transit Center are not even, though these projects seem to be really on similar levels of design?
So the reason we chose the projects that we did to put in there is there's a couple different ways we do it. One is to fund things that are in our CIP, which is approved by the board, and it'll be approved by the board next month. The other thing we do is we try to maximize other use of other people's money. So we try to get as much of the federal funding that we can to come into this region. And so we highlight whatever is going to be most competitive. So there's a huge program in the federal budget that it allows for discretionary grants to be approved for bus and bus-related facilities. It's a gigantic program that we always go after. And so you only can apply for bus and bus-related facilities for that program. The other thing is that you also want to go after money where you know you're going to be competitive because it's ready-to-go projects. So if it's not really a ready-to-go project, they tend to give the money to Seattle or somewhere else that has the, you know, CEQA's already done. They're just waiting on the dollars. With regard to the ferry, the reason we added that was because ANOFA came out a couple weeks ago from the federal government for a ferry program. That's dedicated money just for ferries. And we have heard here at the board, especially with discussions of Elevate, though we took the ferry program out of the Elevate program of projects, there was still some interest in doing something, perhaps a pilot with the military bases. We've met with the military bases, and they've really expressed an interest in reinstating some kind of a military-based program for ferries. And so That was something we threw on there. Are we going to be competitive? We don't know. We're starting to look at this. Heather's group is, you know, trying to see what we could do with those dollars. It's a, I think, $24 million national program, so chances are
it's pretty slim.
It's pretty slim.
Okay.
But with regard to the intermodal transit center at the border, mm-hmm. that's not even a project yet. It's a concept that was floated by Sandag in a study several years back. That type of project is a regional project, and under our statutory authority, that's actually a Sandag-type project. We could help fund it, but we wouldn't be the designated recipient on that. That would be something that Sandag could apply for funds for.
Okay. And just educate me here for the 2020 federal and state legislative programs. In layman's terms, this is what we are going to be asking our lobbyists to look at the state and federal level, right?
Yeah. What it does is it helps us when a bill comes forward and, for instance, the California Transit Association says this is really going to have impacts for transit. What do you think the impacts are going to be? So I might then, you know, pull together materials and send it to them to help them lobby, or I might actually have our lobbyists pursue something. So for instance,
okay.
the bus on shoulders, that's been something that we've really been trying to pursue, because that's something that here in our region we want to reinstate, because we used to have that authority and now we don't.
And is there a reason why this is coming before we approve the capital improvement projects? You mentioned we are going to be improving next month the capital improvement projects.
It's just a calendar-based program, so we just do it typically either January or February, depending on how busy the calendar is. Most of these things were on the last year's program of, and actually for decades. You know, it's kind of standard stuff. You know, we want to be able to control our own budgets as much as we can. We want to get as much funding as much as we can, things like that. So there's really, it's more just a calendar-based thing, and we can certainly move it to May or whenever.
Or move the capital improvement project before, the approval of the capital improvement projects before we approve this. I mean, regardless of what we do next year. I think that... even though the San Ysidro, regardless of what happens with or who takes on the San Ysidro Intermodal Transit Center, I think we should be advocating for funding at a state and federal level. Everybody should be. And so I propose that we amend the federal legislative program to request federal capital project funding for the Blue Line Express as well as the San Ysidro Intermodal Transit Center. And that's a motion.
All right. Any Councilmember Montgomery?
I will second. Just two quick comments. I agree with my colleagues that next year I would like to discuss this, provided I'm serving on this board. And also, just with regard to the three items that have been stricken, without further explanation, I would not support the protecting the records of transit code compliance officers to the same degree as sworn officers. On its face, I would not support that, although I'm open to discussion about it. Thank you.
Got it. Okay, so we have a motion to adopt item 7 with that change. We have a second to that. Councilmember Aguirre.
Thank you. I want to echo my colleague's sentiment about the items regarding public safety, and I appreciate the chair's initiative to have that considered by the committee. But I would like to make a motion to table this whole program and bring it up at our next meeting, so not just the board members but also the public has ample time to do their due diligence and research and look at what legislation's on the slate, especially at the state level, which we already know this is the beginning of the year. We know that what our members are going to be working on. So that would be my motion.
Well, we have a motion and a second to adopt it, so we would have to vote that down first.
No, I'm happy unless staff says that there's some.
You just want to withdraw your motion?
No, I don't. I can amend my motion.
Could I have a?
And as long as I get a second, then we'll be fine.
Sure.
I just needed a clarification. So for the motion to add those two projects onto the list of what we're going to see capital. Is it your intent that we will apply for funding for that in this cycle, or is it your intent?
My intent is that we advocate for it and that our fantastic lobbyists in the state of California and Washington, D.C., start thinking about the fact that we are going to be focused on okay. the Blue Line and the San Ysidro Intermodal Transit Center. And if my Roberts Rules of Order education helps me today, I think I could amend the motion to stipulate that this be heard at next month's board meeting. And considering that my wonderful seconder of the motion accepts, then I'm we can
great.
Move
so
forward.
We have a motion to add that component. We're going to remove the three public safety, which were already removed, and have it come back to the board next month for further discussion or input. All in favor, say aye. That motion carries. Moving on to, we're going to take closed session at the end or around 11 o'clock, depending upon how we're doing. So we will now move to item 30. This is a discussion item, information sharing. Does not require board action.
Thank you, Chair Fletcher, members of the board. This morning we're going to review items number 30 and 31. Item 30 is going to be a presentation on the results of the San Diego Transit Pension Plan investment return. And item 31 is going to be the resulting actuarial valuation for the San Diego Transit Pension Plan. Item 30, again, is the performance, and Jeremy Miller will be doing that presentation. And then items 31, the actuarial analysis, we have Ann Harper and Alice Alsberg that will be doing that presentation.
I'll try and move quickly and make sure we get through all the information here. I'll go ahead and get started on slide 2, investment structure. You can see as of 6/30/2019, to end your fiscal year, total fund assets at the bottom of the table ending $170.8 million. You can see those assets are diversified across four broad asset class categories. Our goal with these assets is to maximize return while also assuming a prudent level of risk. In other words, the assets are there to satisfy the liabilities. So we need to consider the liability structure as we structure the assets. One thing that is taken into consideration is the closed nature of the plan that was closed back in 2011. And we show how the risk profile of the assets have changed since that time from 2011 to 2019. You can see the volatility reduction from 16% to 6%, which on a percentile rank has also come down significantly as well. So the liability structure, which is maturing and outflows, additional net outflows are increasing each year, which you'll see throughout the liability presentation, would suggest that your asset structure should also become more conservative, diversified, and liquid over time. Again, as those assets are there to satisfy the liability. So less emphasis on the equity allocation and more emphasis on the capital preservation side of things due to the mature nature of the plan. Some other things we've tried to do is, as risk has come down, we've also tried to lower the fee structure. Fees have been reduced from 65 basis points to 50 basis points over time. So a 15 basis point reduction, which has translated to savings of over $700,000 in investment manager fees over the last four fiscal years. You can see in the following slide, investment details, we provide additional information on the varying strategies. You can see that assets are allocated over 10 different strategies or products. This product diversification helps to reduce the overall risk of the portfolio And we control the manager sizes, so that also helps to reduce the concentration risk within any particular strategy. The following slide, we get into performance for 2019. On here, we show both fiscal year and calendar year performance to help illustrate the endpoint sensitivity of those returns, depending on which month you look at, which trailing window it can affect the level of return. So you can see the fiscal year, you ended a plan return of 5.73% for 2019. The assumed rate of return is 6.75%, so you underperformed by 1.02%. Over the calendar year for 2019, you can see that the plan returned 16.18%. Again, the assumed rate of return is 6.75, so you outperformed over that period by 9.43%. On the following slide, further illustrates the time sensitivity, endpoint sensitivity. The very top in the table there, you can see that same number from the previous slide, the 5.73% for the 1 year. You see the rolling or trailing periods, 3, 10, and since inception, 1982, returns all greater than the 6.75% return that we need for the actuarial rate of return. So year over year, you see returns can fluctuate fairly significantly, but as you look over the long run, your returns in that top line have done consistently well, despite the fact that you have a lower risk profile due to the liability nature of your plan. And we also think that this positions the portfolio well going forward, given how far we are into the economic cycle. We think a lower risk plan will position your assets well to satisfy the liability streams in the future. With that, happy to answer any questions that you
have. I have a question. Can you just talk a little bit more in depth? So the calendar year rate of return was 16.18, which is far in excess of our 6.75, but then the fiscal year was a little lower. Is that just the normal fluctuation in the markets?
Yeah, so it's exactly, yes. It's just normal fluctuations in the market. 2018, there was a significant dip there as Fed was raising rates and markets got concerned. And so the back half of that year, which was the start of your fiscal year, impact that significantly. But as you look and markets started to recover in 2019, you only got a portion of that in your fiscal year, whereas the rest of that came at the tail end of that calendar year. And so it's just, yes, normal fluctuations in the market.
Are there any concerns at all that the 6.75 assumed rate of return may be too high? Is there anything in the numbers, the data, the history of the few years, your projections moving forward that would lead you that we should be concerned? The 16 is high, the 5.73 is a little bit low, but the average of those two obviously puts us considerably above our assumed rate. Is there any reason you think we should be considering lowering that?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to steal the actuary's thunder, but certainly as we get later in the cycle and as we've had significantly good returns over the last 10 years, that I think there needs to be a discussion about that.
The 6.75% assumed rate of return was just reduced by the board this year from 7%. So the board had taken action to actually lower that discount rate by 25 basis points. What we're seeing with most systems is that we're reviewing that discount rate annually at this point, just because of the market dynamics, and it's changing so frequently. So we tend to revisit that every year. And this was an off-cycle reduction for the board.
Right.
We normally only look at assumptions every 5 years. So it was asked last year to actually take a look at what that interest rate was, that discount rate, and the board took action this year. Now, if something similar, you'd like to do it again this year, we'd be more than happy to look at it again. Mm-hmm. So it's
well, given we lowered it once, but I do think I wouldn't want to wait 5 years to potentially revisit it. I think it's wise and prudent of the board that we keep an eye on it, and
sure.
Even though we just did a lowering,
right.
It may not be the time to lower it again, but I think it's worth
yes.
continuing to keep an eye on
yeah.
on an annual basis.
And like
basis.
I said, we do this for most of the systems that I work on. We actually revisit it almost every year now.
Right. Can you touch on a little bit the nature of our system being a closed system versus an open system and any impact that that may have on decisions we make? Is there any difference? Or
I'll speak from the asset side of things. Certainly, it affects how we want to structure that portfolio, because the point of having those assets is to satisfy those liabilities. So, as your plan becomes more mature, it becomes incumbent upon us, RBK, as your investment consultant, to work more closely with the actuaries to make sure that if you have a more mature plan that requires more frequent outflows and larger outflows, that we would probably want to have a more conservative plan to make sure that we have the money readily available to satisfy those needs. So from an asset side of things, yes, we would structure the portfolio differently and make it less risky as you become more mature.
And what on the actuarial side, when the plan was closed back in 2012, the decision was made to fund the total unfunded accrued liability over the course of several years and to be fully paid in 2037. And to keep that plan in place, anytime there are assumption changes, such as we just did this year, we continue to keep that same time frame of paying that unfunded accrued liability off. And so we're still targeted to have everything, most of the unfunded paid by 2037. As we get closer to that end date, we may want to take a look, too, at that funding policy, because any changes get pushed closer and closer to that date. It's a shorter time frame, so you might be seeing bigger spikes in your contribution. But we're talking years down the road for that.
Okay. With that, we'll go to board discussion. I would just make a motion that we adopt the recommendation with the understanding that even though we just did one reduction, we want to keep an eye on this, and I would definitely like the board to, on an annual basis, look at this and consider any future adjustments. So we have a motion. Is there a second?
Right now we're only on agenda item 30, which is information. So I think that your motion maybe relates to 31.
Okay, I thought we were doing 30 and 31.
Yeah.
We're doing
okay. 30's over. Do 31.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have a question on 30? You have a question on 30? Okay.
So first of all, thank you for the presentation. I'd like to point out, as was mentioned, fiscal year 19, our total investment return was 5.73. If we recall, for those of us that were here back in April during the formulation of our budget, the board, as was mentioned, voted to lower our assumption rate of return from 7 to 6.75. With the benefit of hindsight, this was a very prudent move on our end, so much so that we should probably consider lowering the assumption by an additional 25 basis points so that our assumed rate of return matches SDSERS. As was mentioned, we have a closed system, pension system, and I think we should be more cautious with our assumptions. So I'm actually, with all due respect, Chairman, I'm not in support of not lowering that return, the rate.
Fair enough. Mr. Sienke?
More than 20% of our portfolio is in this thing called alternatives multi-asset parentheses. There's probably a page somewhere in my report that describes that more clearly in language I can't understand. So would you talk a little bit more about that particular part of our portfolio?
Sure. So on the investment details, it references the two managers associated with those allocations, the PIMCO All Asset Fund and the GMO Benchmark Free Fund. Both of those still hold traditional stocks and bonds, but we give the managers a little more latitude to invest outside of the U.S. to help capture some of the opportunities internationally that maybe we wouldn't capture in, say, the Vanguard passive index that we hold for bonds or in some of the other equity funds that we hold. So it's just a broader opportunity set that allows managers to capture international opportunities, but also help to reduce correlations and therefore also reduce risk for the portfolio.
And so the earlier slide that talked about the reduction in basis points for the fee for the fund, that going from 7.5 to 0.5%, which is great. My understanding of how mutual funds work is there's fee structures embedded in those funds as well. I'm assuming that those are particularly more than 0.5% in terms of those investments. Is that correct?
Yeah, so some of these would be more than 0.5%. Certain asset classes, the fee structures are higher. If you're looking at, say, a small cap manager versus a large cap manager, those sorts of things. So one of the things we do is every year we benchmark every single manager that you have in your portfolio and make sure that based on a third-party database institutional quality list, that your fees compare favorably in that universe. And right now, these managers, I think a lot of them would be bottom quartile fees. So we will say often to the committee that looks at investments, lower fees are a head start in the race for returns. So it's something that we actively pursue, trying to make sure that you have the most favorable fees available for each of these asset classes.
Okay, so with the 0.5%, that's great for the overall program, but we're paying more than that in fees for our services, correct?
That would be it for your investment managers. All in for the total portfolio across all of the managers would average out to that 50 basis points.
Okay, thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. Any other questions on item 30? Councilmember Montgomery.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just a quick question about the rate. How often do we look at this yearly and make a decision on that yearly? Is that
that's what I'm proposing. Okay. Normally it's 5 years. I think we look at it. We made a out of cycle adjustment last year where we lowered it.
Okay.
Not on the normal cycle, and so that's just going into effect. And so now we decide it now, and I think it should come back every year instead of every 5 years, so that we can look at the trends and what's happening and make any adjustments.
So does this informational item check off our year or?
Well, the 31 will.
31?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Councilmember Galvez.
And also, I think that in the spring, the graph was particularly helpful showing what the disbursement schedule would be like with our adjusted rate. So if you could continue to show us that data, that would be great.
Great. All right. We will move, thank you, on item 30. We'll move to item 31.
Good morning. My name is Ann Harper, and I have Alice Osberg with me, and we are the actuaries for the San Diego Transit retirement plans. Today we're going to talk about a few things. When we do an actuarial evaluation, what we like to do is we like to look a little bit at the plan history. We then like to see where we are today. And most importantly, we like to look at the plan future and the direction of the plan. And to start off with, that direction has not changed since the last time we were here. It's still on track to pay off that unfunded accrued liability in 2037. So last year, the valuation of the contribution was $15.9 million. That contribution requirement has gone up to about $17.5 million, so a $1.5 million increase. What we do with actuarial evaluations, we look at the plan experience compared to the assumptions, and we make adjustments. And so the two biggest factors of the increase in the contribution were first that increase to the discount rate, or decrease to the discount rate from 7 to 6.75, and that increased the contributions by about $700,000. The next item was your actual investment experience. So the plan, as Jeremy had said, underperformed for fiscal year end 2019. That had an impact of about $700,000. And in addition to that, there were some losses from back in 2015 and 2016 that we smooth in over time, and we also smooth in gains over time. So we're actually recognizing some of those losses as well for this year. The actual demographics to the plan, the demographic assumptions, things like retirement rates, terminations, salaries, and COLAs, that experience was less favorable. It increased the contribution by about $300,000. And the majority of that was due to cost of living increases for your retirees. They actually received, there were a lot of increases around 3, 4, and 5% this year, and our assumption is a 2% increase. So that is the biggest cause for that. And then the dynamic of your closed plan. Since there are fewer actives every year through attrition, and since the plan is closed, you don't have new membership. So there are fewer benefits being accrued in your plan. Not that every active is accruing less benefits, you just have less benefits on a whole that are accruing. So that was a decrease of about $180,000. So looking at your plan history, this is the contributions to your plan over the last decade. You can see in the last 5 or 6 years, those contributions have remained around between $12 and $14 million, absent of any assumption changes. You can see at the very beginning of the decade how the contribution ramped up, and that was mainly due to the fact that of the investment losses in 2008 and 2009 that get phased in over 5 years. So what we're showing here too, in the last 4 years, we're showing the impact of the assumption changes that have been made. So the blue, the teal bars represent the increase in the contribution due to the assumption changes back in 2016. One was going from 7.5% assumed rate of return down to 7%. And another assumption that was changed was your mortality assumption. Members are living longer. And throughout the industry, we had a change in our mortality assumptions. We're actually projecting mortality improvements in the future as well. So that had a very large impact. That was actually 60% of that teal bar. So that impacted your plan back then by about $3 million. Then the next layer is that little gold bar on top, and that represents your current discount rate reduction from 7% to 6.75%. So just showing kind of that layering of the contribution rate based on what those assumption changes and how they impacted your contribution. Any questions?
No, thank you. I will. We'll go to board discussion. I think the.
Quicker.
Oh, more slides?
Oh yeah, there's more slides. I was just saying if there's any questions. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay, so now this is showing your plan history for your funding ratios. The bars represent your liabilities, and as you can see, the liabilities in the last 4 years have been impacted as well by those assumption changes because our funding target is increasing. That's your accrued liability. Again, we are stacking those bars with the impact of those assumption changes. The gold bars represent your assets, and then the gray and teal and blue bars represent your liabilities. And you can see the funded ratio has dropped to about 56%. And if there had been no changes in your assumptions, then you'd be at about 65% funding. Now I'm going to turn it over to Alice and talk a little bit more about some risk disclosures that we had to put in our report, and also the most important is our projections.
Thank you. So we would like to bring to your attention that within the actuarial profession, we have certain actuarial standards of practice that we are required to adhere to. And effective with the July 1st, 2019 actuarial valuation for your plan, there is a new section within the valuation report which covers this ASOP, this actuarial standard of practice 51, which compiles, it's an assessment and disclosure of the risks of the plan. So it goes through the investment risk, inflation risk, contribution risk, and other risks which are inherent in your plan, all in one section of the report so that you can be better informed on the variability that could come through these various risks to your plan.
And we specifically added some risk to your plan that specifically address the closed nature of the plan as well.
And looking at this graphic here, we take a look at the change and the trend in the membership of the system. The bars in this graph represent the total membership count, so active members, terminated members who are not yet eligible for retiree benefits, and members who are in pay status. And it's very clear through the gold bar, the trend here that's seen over this 10-year period, is that active membership, because of the closed nature of the plan, has declined. The active membership has gone down by 45%. And with that shift, the benefits are now in pay status. Those actives have gone into pay status, and we have a larger number of retirees who are receiving benefits. Above this graph, there's also a line. That line is an indication of the maturity of the plan. So Jeremy talked about the maturing plan, that closed nature of the plan, and the line that's depicted here is an actual measurement of that maturity. So in 2010, the line shown there, it's called the support ratio. How many inactives are being supported by contributions coming in from the actives? So the support ratio in 2010 was 1.5, whereas now in 2019, that support ratio is all the way at 3. So it's doubled. And that's a clear indicator of the maturing nature of your plan. And with that indicator, it really reinforces where the investments have gone to more secure, less risk investments. The projected contributions for the plan show a dramatic cliff in 2037. So the contribution for the fiscal year 2020-2021 is $17.5 million. And that contribution remains relatively stable as the contribution, as that unfunded actuarial liability is paid off. And it's in 2037 that the entire unfunded portion is paid off, and the remaining payments into the future beyond that point will just be the normal cost. So the accrued benefits with expenses, with expected expenses going forward after that point.
Yeah, and the normal cost is just the cost of the actives that are still left in the plan and their benefits that are actually accruing.
Ann was discussing the funded status of the plan, that the plan is currently 56% funded. So the top of the bars here show the total liability in the plan, whereas the line is the assets. And you can see that right now in 2019, the assets are about halfway. So we have 56% assets to liabilities. But as the plan makes its way through its projected funding policy, making those contributions to the UAL, to the unfunded benefit, unfunded payment amounts, you see that that funded ratio, the ratio at the top in 2037, reaches 100% funded. So that's the state where the plan will be 100% funded. The assets will be there to match the liabilities for the future benefits of the participants. And with that, are there any questions?
Just one quick point. I think those last two slides are kind of the takeaways. And 8 years ago, back in 2012, the board made the decision to, in terms of the closed plan and the funding nature and how that unfunded liability was going to be paid off. And we're still on track. We've gone 8 years. We're a third of the way through the process. We have another 16 or so years until we hit 2037. And so the plan that that was developed back then is working, and we're at a point and a strategy to get to that 100% funded and completely paid off of that unfunded actuarial liability. So,
great, thank you. So with that, I'll just restate the motion. And it's just to provide the context, and I'm very sensitive to the concerns of Councilmember Moreno, and I think it's something we have to watch very closely. I think given, you know, we went from 7.5 to 7, and then last year off cycle, we went from 7 to 6.75, which I think was a prudent thing to do. And was appropriate. The fiscal year number at 573 is a little concerning, but then you look at the calendar year number at over 16%, and I think that it can be encouraging. And then I think the nature of our plan being in less risky and more secure investments provides less possibility of greater instability. And so I think at this point, with the understanding that I believe we should evaluate this every year before we make our budgetary decisions, and so around this time every year and not every 5 years, I would make a motion to adopt the recommendation for 2017. So we have a motion and a second, and then we'll start with Councilmember Moreno, and then we'll go to Mayor Salas.
Thank you for the presentation. I'd like to sound a note of caution. The graph on page 10, if you can go to slide 10, please, which is a projection of total plan contributions, shows a gradual reduction of our contribution, dropping to 13.6 million by 2033, and then falling off a cliff in 2037, dropping all the way down to 1.3 million. Great news, right? I would hold off on any celebration, though, because this assumes that the plan earns the 6.75% assumed rate of investment return every single year. We know that this won't happen, so I'd like to draw your attention to the very colorful graph on page 17, which is the, and I'm going to butcher this, stochastic projection of total contribution.
On the report.
I'm sorry?
In the report.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's we have it as page 17, so if you could.
Oh.
It's in the report, not the presentation.
Got you. I'm sorry. This shows a range of potential contributions. For instance, in year 2033, this graph shows that our contributions could range from 0 to 25 million, not the 13.6 million we saw when we assumed a constant rate of return in the previous graph. And the stochastic projection shows that we're likely to continue paying into this pension fund for many years to come. And it is very likely on any given year that we could end up paying more. Given that we will be stuck with this pension payment for decades to come, I think it's worth it to re-examine some key assumptions. Additionally, I think that one of the main challenges this plan faces is that it's closed to new members. Because we have a closed plan, we don't have new members contributing, and those contributions earning investment returns. So if this plan were open to new members, what actuarial effects would this have, and have we looked at that in depth?
If the plan was still open?
If we were to open it back up to new members.
We have not examined that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but fair to say that the contributions would be significantly higher than they are today.
The projection in 2012 when we closed this plan, and is the reason that we took that step, is that the annual contribution would be in excess of $33 million. And the board determined at that time we just couldn't afford it.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation. And as I mentioned, I will not be supporting the motion on the floor.
Fair enough. Mayor Salas.
Just a little bit more information when it comes back next year for consideration. It would be also added information for us if we were able to see, had we not lowered the assumption rate, what would have the liability been at this point? So I think it's really good to make that comparison to see if we indeed do have to continue to lower it and what that means.
I'd agree with that. Great. Any other questions? All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That motion carries. We're going to break for closed session right now. We'll ask the board to go into the conference room. We'll do closed session and then we'll come back. Our remaining items are informational, and so my apologies to those who are here, but we will have two items in closed session, and then we will be back to complete the rest of the agenda. Thank you.
All right, while everybody is settling back, I'm just going to report out of closed session on item number 24A, closed session conference with real property negotiators regarding the 5159 Baltimore Drive property. The board received a report and gave instructions to negotiators. And on item number 24B, closed session conference with legal counsel regarding existing litigation, MTS versus Grand Central West, the board received a report and gave instructions to legal counsel.
All right, we will pick up here with our Midcoast feeder bus plan updates.
Excuse me. Good morning. I'm here with Rodrigo Carrasco, senior planner and project manager for the Midcoast feeder bus plan. The Midcoast project is full steam ahead with construction, with the Blue Line expected to start service late next year. And as part of that, we are looking at our bus network that is in the area and how we can reallocate resources and move things around to better feed people into the Blue Line trolley. There is no project funding for additional bus services, so everything that we're going to bring to you today is just reallocating existing resources. There's no new additional resources coming into this. Now, what we're presenting today are proposals that are coming out of the feeder bus study. We're not actually asking for approval of any changes today. That will come next year during a major service change and public hearing process. These are just the results of the study that we'd like to share with you. So our goals were to connect adjacent communities into the trolley extension and to extend our high-frequency service network, which we've used so successfully in other locations, other communities, extend that to the areas that are adjacent to the new Midcoast corridor. Again, this is a budget-neutral program. We began it about 2 years ago. We started some outreach, which Rodrigo will get into a little more detail on. We've also been doing some market research and developing the proposals, doing scheduling and costing, that kind of thing. We expect to totally wrap up the study this spring. And at that point, we'll post it on our website. We have a project website, and we'll collect some public feedback and have final proposals for, again, that public hearing process next spring.
So outreach for the feeder bus plan consisted of presentations to the community planning groups and committees. Then also we had community workshops that had interactive activities. We had storyboards there, provided information. The participants were able to discuss the plan and the process with the planners. Then we also administered surveys. We did social media outreach on different platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And then also on the project page, we had the same materials that were available at the public forums and the same surveys available online for anybody to participate in. So our main takeaways from the outreach and the surveys were that, so the respondents that participated, they live near the Midcoast Trolley. You know, there's the communities around there are dense with participants, but really people participated from throughout our service area. And then the second takeaway was, although the participants lived dispersed, their destinations were very much clustered around the Midcoast Trolley alignment and the future stations. So, you know, a lot of commute trips to our major hub, employment hub, Sereno Valley, Torrey Pines, University City, UCSD. And then the third takeaway is that the majority of respondents, 55%, they plan to ride the bus to the Midcoast Trolley stations, which is great, being that, you know, we are redesigning our bus service to bring people to the stations from the surrounding communities and throughout the network. And then also the preferences of the survey respondents. So they value higher service frequency, span, and travel time, and the proximity of bus stops to both the origin and destination over amenities such as phone charging, Wi-Fi, and bike sharing. And also, we did outreach and collected some data from Biotech, which represents the, or Biocom, which represents the biotech industry. And we found that a lot of the biotech employees, they live in the bedroom community surrounding Sereno Valley and University City, along the I-56 or the SR-56 corridor, at Mira Mesa also, and Pacific Beach. But they all are also widely dispersed throughout the region.
So similar to how we operate services in all the areas where the trolley is already running, we focused on the areas, on the bus services operating in the areas that are along the Midcoast corridor. So roughly north of Mission Valley and, excuse me, to the west of 163 and 15. All our bus services in these areas right now, a majority of them are north-south oriented. We have about a half dozen routes that go from the Mission Valley, downtown, Old Town area, up into the UTC, UCSD area. So we want to look at those resources that are going into those routes now that we have the blue line that will be this major trunk corridor, and look at those north-south resources and reallocate those so that we're feeding actually into the Midcoast from other communities. So the only real east-west connector that we have across all these communities right now is our Route 27. It only operates every 30 minutes on weekdays and 60 on Saturdays and not at all on Sundays. So I'm going to go really quickly through the proposals that are coming out of the study at this point. On the left, you see our current network in these areas. And the routes that we've put in a color there. Those are only the routes that we're changing. So there's a variety of other routes that are in dark gray lines there that we won't talk about. And then the map on the right is the proposed network. So to go through these really quickly, our routes 50 and 150 are express services between downtown and UTC. One goes up I-5, one goes through Claremont. We're proposing to take those resources and reallocate those to other routes. The Route 27 that I mentioned, going over to the east side of the Midcoast Corridor, we're proposing to split Route 27 at Balboa Station and actually run that every 15 minutes up and down the Balboa Corridor between Kearney Mesa and Balboa Station. We're proposing to implement a new route, doing the same thing but along the Claremont Mesa Boulevard Corridor. That's shown here as Route 43, and again, operate that every 15 minutes on weekdays. We actually have, we're participating in an ASIC, Affordable Housing Community, Sustainable Community Strategy grant that will fund part of those services for up to 2 years. Also in the Claremont areas, our Route 105, we'd have a small change of routing up in the northern area to continue serving the South University City and Regents Road corridor once the Route 50 goes away. And we'll still have robust service along Genesee on Route 41. And lastly, Route 44 that now comes up through Linda Vista and goes over and ends at Claremont Square. We would wiggle it over to the east side instead to connect at Kearney Mesa Transit Center into the I-15 Rapid 235. This has been a request that actually came out from before the TOP since 2014 that we've had to connect the I-15 corridor with Mesa College, so we'd finally be able to do that. Going over to the coast side, what we'd like to do is take our Route 8, which runs between Old Town, Mission Beach, and Pacific Beach, and bring that over to form a horseshoe-shaped route and connect it in with Balboa Station. And then make Route 8 one of our core network routes operating every 15 minutes. Our Route 9 that comes up out of Old Town up through SeaWorld and Crown Point, we're proposing to just end that at Ingram and Garnett instead of bringing it over to the beach as it does now. And then Route 30 is currently a route that starts in downtown, goes all the way up to UCSD through Pacific Beach, through La Jolla. We'd like to convert this to more of an express route that would just operate between Old Town and UCSD, operating basically every 15 minutes in peaks, 30 off peaks, and supplement that with a new Route 34. And this would respond to requests from the beach area and La Jolla communities to better feed into the Midcoast trolley service. And so this would come across Garnett Avenue, replacing that Route 27. This would provide local service up through La Jolla, downtown La Jolla and La Jolla Shores, and then across Nobel into UTC. Moving up into the University City community, our Superloop Route 201-202, which during UCSD school days is actually our highest ridership route in the entire system. What we would do is, instead of that going up in the hospitals area, the Scripps and UCSD hospitals area on the northern part of its loop, by UCSD, we'd actually bring it across La Jolla Village Drive, so it'd be a smaller loop, but it would better utilize the resources where we really need them, which is along La Jolla Village Drive, now that we have Midcoast serving those hospitals areas up there. Lastly, we're proposing a new route that would connect the Midcoast to the work sites up in the Torrey Pines area. This would operate similar to our Coaster Connection services. It would operate peaks only on weekdays and just connect as a feeder service from the Pepper Canyon Station at UCSD into these Torrey Pines areas up here. We looked at some options to bring some feeder services into the larger Sereno Mesa area. The problem is when we did timing estimates on this, it actually takes almost an hour to go from UTC down to Sereno Mesa and back up. It was just a huge number of resources, and we already have a Rapid Route 237 that connects these already along Mira Mesa Boulevard. So with that, our next steps are to go ahead and complete this study. Again, it'll be completed this spring. We'll post that on our website so people will be able to take a look at it. We wanted to bring it to the board first, but the public will have an opportunity to comment on that, provide some feedback. We'll go ahead and refine that. And then 6 months prior to the opening of Midcoast, we'll do a full major service change analysis with the Title VI report and the public hearing.
Thank you. We have two requests for public comment on item 45. Steve Hadley and Dan Allen. Welcome. Pleased to have you here. I'll give you 2 minutes
each. Thank you. I'm here on behalf of Council Member Barbara Breed, City of San Diego, who thanks you for including Route 34 in this study in response to community requests. Students at UCSD, freshmen, sophomore specifically, are not allowed to have cars on campus. This now gives them access to our beach communities. La Jolleans who have wanted access up to the new trolley, and specifically UTC, the hospitals and the university, this gives them that as well. If you go on any website and look at tourist attractions in the city of San Diego, La Jolla Caves and Cove and the seals and the sea lions are right there with everything else. This gives our tourists downtown public access and public transit up the Midcoast Trolley and then down 34 to those as well. We have people who work around the region who come into La Jolla. There are thousands of business there. 1,300 belong to the Village Merchants Association alone. And people who work in the offices, the retail, the hotels, the restaurants will now have public transit to and from work, so thank you very much. La Jolla Traffic and Transportation Board has advocated for this for years. Chief among them is Dan Allen, who is here this morning, and we want to thank them for proposing this and pushing for it. We also note that not only Biocom, but UCSD and the other businesses in the UTC area, the majority of the workers are coming from north along the 56 corridor. So thank you for continuing to look at routes up into that area. This morning, though, thank you for Route 34.
We appreciate the confidence in MTS from Councilmember Bree. Thank you for that. Next up, Mr. Dan Allen.
I spoke earlier in the public comment session, and what's been said by staff and by was essentially we're looking forward in the La Jolla community of working with the staff in the next steps as they were shown in the view graph, and then eventually in realizing this project. Thank you. One little thing that's frightening and hear about limited resources. We wouldn't mind if extra resources were put on these shuttle bus connections, and they may very well be what the public wants.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right, this is informational only. If there's no board comments, we thank the staff, and we will move to agenda item 46. Go ahead. One question real quick. Yes.
Just a curiosity, on Route 30, when you say it's going to operate as an express, are there going to be more limited stops?
Yes, definitely, helpful. And then the 34 will be there to act as the local.
And the only segment on here that we seem to have done away with is the old 105 route sort of between Claremont Mesa and sort of the heart of University City. Is there any loss of ridership potential? Is there any really access for users there?
Yes, that actually the entire corridor there is served by Route 41 already, and Route 41 actually operates every 7.5 minutes in peaks.
Not on this map.
I didn't highlight it because we're not changing it, but yep. It's there.
Great, yeah. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Item 46.
All right. Good morning. My name is Gordon Meyer. I'm the Operating Budget Supervisor here at MTS. This morning, we're going to cover the operating budget results through the first 6 months of the fiscal year, or December 2019. So on the first slide, we have a look at our operating revenues through December. So fare revenue through the first 6 months were unfavorable to budget by $18,000, or 0.0%. So passenger revenue during that period was favorable to the prior year by $1.94 million, or 4.2%. Ridership during that same period was favorable to the prior year by 1.2 million passengers, or 2.7%. So same message as last month. So after the September fare change, we have continually missed our targets on passenger revenue, including December. So on the next line, we have our other operating revenue. So through December, we were favorable by $1.3 million, or 13.8%. That's primarily within administration, and that was specifically due to favorable energy credit revenue, interest revenue, and advertising revenue. So all in all, our operating revenues through December were favorable to budget by about $1.3 million, or 2.2%. So on this slide, we have a chart view of our passenger revenue for the first 6 months. So you can see July and August, the red bar, which was our actuals, exceeded the blue bar, which was our budget. September, which was the first month of the fare change, we were slightly favorable to budget by about $50,000. And then October through December, we missed each month by about $170,000 each month. So on the topic of the fare change results, so revenues from September, the first month of the fare change, to December were lower than the fare consultants' projections by a total of $597,000. That shortfall is due primarily to a greater reduction in day pass volumes than anticipated in the consultants' model. So if we jump down to the table at the bottom, you can see how we trended versus the consultants' model for each of the major fare categories so far. So cash fares, we were favorable by $308,000, or 5.4%. Day pass fares, and that's the big drop off, we were unfavorable by $1.8 million, or 16%. Adult monthly passes, we were favorable by $528,000, or 7.4%. SDM monthly, we were unfavorable to the model by $234,000, or 8.3%. Youth monthly, we were favorable by about $120,000, or 10.5%. And college passes, we were favorable by about $507,000, or 23.2%. So all in all, through December, we were unfavorable to the fare consultants model by $597,000, or 2.0%. So we will be revising the passenger revenue down at mid-year, and we'll be finalizing that number tomorrow. So moving on to expenses, so personnel costs through December were unfavorable by $125,000, or 0.2%. Purchase transportation costs were favorable by $1.1 million, or 2.7%. That's primarily due to lower volumes in our paratransit division, as well as favorable standby hours and performance bonuses for our regular fixed route service. Other outside services, we were unfavorable to budget by about $700,000, or 5.2%. That's primarily within administration, and specifically that's our fare change expenses, primarily Cubic. And then we've also been trending unfavorably in security and with the ballot measure expenses. Energy, we were unfavorable by $304,000, or 2.0%, and that's almost entirely our CNG and electricity costs. And then other expenses, we were unfavorable by a little over $1 million, or 8.9%. And that is almost entirely revenue vehicle parts for both our bus and rail operating divisions. So all in all, through December, our operating expenses were unfavorable by a little over $1 million, or 0.7%. So when we roll that up, we had favorable revenues of $1.3 million versus unfavorable expenses of a little over $1 million, totaling a favorable combined net operating variance of $215,000, or 0.2%. Lastly, we have a slide on our ongoing concerns. So our regional sales tax receipts, that impacts both our TDA and our Transnet revenues. We are projecting a pickup of about $11 million regionally through the end of the year. STA, we're projecting to get back or to remain at budget at $28.9 million for the year. Passenger levels, we are projecting a pickup based on the actual experience in the first half of the year. And then energy prices, so CNG, we've been trending slightly unfavorable to date, and we are projecting to remain more unfavorable through the end of the fiscal year, primarily because we just had another SDG&E transportation costs or rate increase that went into effect in January. Propane, we've been trending favorably so far, and we expect to remain favorable through the end of the year. Diesel, we expect to get back to to remain at budget. Gas, we've been trending unfavorably and expect to remain unfavorable. Electricity, we are slightly unfavorable versus the original budget, and we expect to stay there through the end of the fiscal year. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you. We will move to agenda item 59, Elevate SD updates. That's it? Okay, consider yourselves updated. I think we're all updated. We're doing a webinar. We have a webinar going. We have a series. Elevate process obviously is continuing. You all know that. We're continuing the outreach. We're continuing to hone in on the funding plan and doing the network analysis, everything we talked about at length last week. So with that, that'll be my chair report too. Seeing no other need for comments, our next meeting date is March 19th, 2020. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all.